Thank you. Good morning. We're back into a discussion of divine providence. I'm thankful for Dr. Fesco's warning about duels, and I'm also glad that we have instituted the no dueling policy. I think everyone signed a no dueling clause when they came to the conference, which is especially beneficial when you're talking about decree and providence, because passions can run high when we talk about these doctrines and these topics. What I'm considering in this second talk is the doctrine of divine concurrence with created causes. Concurrence with created causes. This is, as it were, that sort of second moment as we talk about divine providence, preservation, concurrence. We'll talk about governance in the fourth talk, but for this talk and for my next one, I want to talk about divine concurrence. In this one, divine concurrence generally, and then in the third talk, we'll talk about divine concurrence, particularly with a focus on the question of evil. Matthew 5:45, he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Philippians 2:13, for it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Our confession, 5:2, says, although in relation to the foreknowledge and decree of God, the first cause, all things come to pass immutably and infallibly, so that there is nothing, there's not anything befalls any by chance or without his providence, yet by the same providence he ordered them to fall out according to the nature of second causes, either necessarily, freely, or contingently. These are three categories of second causes that our confession recognizes in the natural order. God in his ordinary providence, this is 5:3, in his ordinary providence makes use of means. That's what I want to focus on here, the natural means God uses in administering his providence, yet is free to work without, above, and against them at his pleasure. This is basically a brief article on miracles. Okay? The fact that God has ordinary providence using ordinary means does not mean that he is not free to produce outcomes in other extraordinary ways. First, then, the importance of the doctrine of divine concurrence. Originally, when theologians talked about providence, they tended to focus on preservation and government. The question of divine concurrence, though, now sort of inserted as a middle consideration when we think about this, or the doctrine of divine cooperation, we'll talk about what that means, with created causes, was in order to defend the Christian doctrine against both pantheism and deism. The tendency of deism was to affirm the real causal agency of creatures and to generally banish God's causal activity from the world in order to ensure that he did not cancel out natural causes. So in order to guarantee that it really was a necessary, a free, or contingent cause that was doing the causing, God had to, as it were, step aside. God had to make room for other agents to do their work, to operate. That's deism in a nutshell. God would, as it were, be smothering and crowding out his own creation if he were imminently involved in the activities of all that is going on. Concurrence is, on the side of deism, an attempt to say, God does not absent himself in working when creatures work. That's the deist conception. The tendency of pantheism was precisely the opposite, in that it so affirmed universal divine agency that it no longer acknowledged genuine non-divine causes. So on the one side, deism says there are non-divine causes, therefore God can't be doing any causing in that event. Pantheism says there's only a divine cause, and therefore there are no what we call second causes or created causes. There's no creature actually doing anything in terms of agency. Concurrence is also designed to resist that, so that we don't want to collapse all causality into divine causality and say nothing else acts or does anything. Okay. By the same token, we don't want to say, well, if other things act or do things, God then can't be acting in that moment. Both views, though, deism and pantheism, share the common belief that God and the creature cannot both be causal agents producing the exact same effect. In other words, whether you're a pantheist or deist, the cosmology that they both subscribe to is basically the same with regard to agency, which is basically this. Only one agent can be producing a single effect. You cannot have two agents producing the same effect, at least not without sharing the load by portions. And to the extent then, in short then, to the extent God acts causally, the creature doesn't act causally. And inversely, to the extent the creature acts causally, God doesn't. That's the common cosmological outlook of both deism and pantheism, and our doctrine of divine concurrence is intended to resist not just pantheism or deism, but rather the cosmology that they share in common. Either God acts and the creature doesn't, or the creature acts and God doesn't. Pantheism says creatures don't act, only God does. Deism says basically creatures act and God stands aside. Orthodox Christians, then, have long perceived a raft of problems to follow from both of the viewpoints. Against deism, if God is not acting causally in the world at all times, and yet the world continues to exist and to operate, then some sort of cosmological dualism follows. Basically, you have a set of first principles. There's God in the world. God is not the one making the world be. The world now is existing independently of him and moving independently of him. This means that there are several first causes in the world and several beings exhibiting self-sufficient existence. Basically, multiple au-say beings. God can only stand alongside other beings in such a world, like one of the territorial gods of the nations, a finite regional power who must give way to other powers and who can only execute his will by either overpowering them or soliciting their help and making himself dependent upon them. Okay? But he cannot be acting in their action. He can either depend upon their action to help him do what he wants to do, or he can override their action and cancel it out and do what he wants to do, but he cannot be at work in their work. Okay? Against pantheism, if no creature genuinely causes anything, then God is the sole and immediate cause of all good and evil. Or even worse, there is no real distinction between good and evil, and all that occurs is just God developing himself through a world process. That really is pantheism. Pantheism is God just sort of growing and developing and emerging in terms of his own being, and there really is no creature and creaturely agency whatsoever. It follows then that there could be no such thing as moral culpability among rational creatures, since no rational creature really does anything if you're a pantheist. Only God does. See, if God acts, you can't act. But God acts everywhere, the pantheist says. Therefore, you act nowhere. Moral culpability is gone. There is no doing, good or evil, of your own. No good deeds, no wicked deeds. No heaven, no hell. Pantheism removes all creaturely agency, moral and otherwise. For obvious reasons, we have to stand against both of these alternatives. There's also occasionalism that I will mention only briefly. Occasionalism argues that there's only one true cause, namely God, and that what looks like causal interaction in the created order only looks that way to us. But what God's actually doing is he's creating activity, and he's creating effects, but he has not established any actual causal link between creaturely activity and creaturely effects. It only appears that way. So on the occasion of me scratching my head and feeling like that, you know, relieves me, God has only sort of lined it up so that the feeling of relief I get when I scratch and the activity of scratching, it seems like scratching caused the relief, but there was no causal connection between my hand and the relief that I felt. God just simply created an action and an effect, but there is no causal connection between them. There is no creaturely agency performing and doing anything causally. Nicholas Malebranche, the most famous occasionalist, says that all natural causes are not true causes, but only occasional causes. They are the occasions of God's causing. This is sort of a poor man's pantheism, if you will. We'll leave it with that. So preservation on the one side, we talked about last night, governance, which we'll talk about later today, on the other side, might appear to be nothing but God's self-sustenance and self-lordship if pantheism were true. In other words, preservation would just be self-preservation and government would just be self-government because there is no actual creaturely activity to be governing or preserving if pantheism is true, even if you bother to have a doctrine of preservation and governance on pantheism. And of course, neither preservation nor governance could be true in the deist account. Concurrence and divine cooperation with creaturely causes is thus a necessary piece of any confession of providence that aims to avoid falling into either the pit of pantheism or deism. In order to do so, it's necessary not just that we reject pantheism or deism, but that we reject the cosmology that says there can be only primary causes in the production of any single effect. And our confession says that he orders his providence through second causes. This is the way that you avoid pantheism or deism, by avoiding the cosmology that generates them. So much for the introduction. What is the importance of concurrence? It saves the creator-creature distinction. Secondly, then, created causes. And this I want to talk about creaturely causes and make the argument that they are caused causes, or if you will, moved movers, or let me just say, created causes. The first thing that should be said of anything that is not God is that that being is cause to be. Is it God or is it not God? It's not God. Then it is cause to be. That is to say, it's creature. When it comes to the question of being, there are two answers. It is God or it is something made to be. Okay? If it is not God, it is created. And the cause of its being, the cause of the creature's being, is, as we said last night, a continuous cause, because what is caused in the creature, existence, is not transformed into the nature of the creature. We do not become self-existent entities. We depend at every moment of our being for an influx of divine actualism that makes us be. Relevant then to our present concern, we should say that no creature acts as a causal agent except through the immediate agency of divine power by which it exists. In other words, there's no you there to even do anything if there's not God making you be there, so that you don't act apart from God who makes you be. At no moment do you, as it were, detach from the mother ship, so to speak, and sort of go off your own way, wholly self-sustaining and independent. If you act, you only act because God makes you be. In him we live, move, and have our being. We'll come back to that. Thomas Aquinas puts this very succinctly. A thing does not give being except insofar as it is an actual being. You think you can't understand Thomas, but you really can. He's basically saying this. If you don't exist, you can't do anything. Right? Rocket science? It is not. Okay? A thing can only act insofar as it has actual being. But God preserves the being in things in being by his providence. Therefore, it is as a result of divine power that a thing gives being. That's operation. Giving being is operation. Doing things, you know, like producing outcomes, doing things, giving being. You can only do this because of God who gives being to us. We might think, okay, well, God makes me be, but does he make me act? He makes me exist, but does he make me, in addition to existing, actually do things? I could say this thing exists, but that doesn't necessarily mean this thing actually does anything as an agent, as a cause. So does God only cause my existence, or does he also cause my agency, my acts of doing? Back again to Thomas, he enlarges his point. But just as God has not only given being to things when they first began to exist, but also causes being in them as long as they exist, conserving things in being, that is what we talked about last night, so also he has not merely granted operative powers to them when they were originally created, but he always causes these powers in things. Hence, if the divine influence, he means of being, were to cease, every operation, cause-effect relation in the world, would cease. Therefore, every operation of a thing is traced back to him as its cause. Again, I point us at just this point to Paul's words in Acts 17:28. In him we live, what's the second term? Move and have our being. Paul, in the way he phrases it there, citing the pagan poets, but approvingly in this case, is making a distinction between existing, in him we have our being, and moving. You see, the thing is not just that you are, it's not just that you exist, you actually do things. You cause things to come about. You don't just sit there statically, you also move. Is it just your being that comes from God, or is it the movement of your being? Is it the doing and the activity of your being that also comes from God? Aquinas is basically reflecting and contemplating on the implications of Acts 17:28. In him we live, move, and have our being. Both movement and being are from God. In Isaiah 10:15, if you remember this text, God has used the nation of Assyria as the rod of his anger to chastise the northern kingdom of Israel for their wickedness. And as a tool in God's hand, Assyria becomes sort of inflated and self-important, thinking that they are having all these military victories according to their own strength and their own power. And God rebukes them with these words, Isaiah 10:15. Shall the axe boast over him who hews with it? Or the saw magnify itself against him who wields it? I pause for a second. That's what you are. You are a tool in my hand. Yes, you are moving. You are doing things. You are devastating nations because I have sent you to do that. But don't think that you're moving independently of me wielding you. That would be like the axe saying, look at the tree I chopped down all by myself. Or it's actually even more bizarre than that. He goes on, as if the rod should wield him who lifts it, as if the secondary cause actually turned itself into a primary cause. Look at what I made the woodsman do to the tree. That seems a little backward. You know what I mean? We've got to take that axe aside and have a little conversation about who wields who, okay? As if the rod should wield him who lifts it. It's really bizarre. It's like an axe moving a woodsman. You're supposed to this is supposed to strike you as madness. When creatures think that they act independently of God, or that God acts through them because they take the initiative, that's like the axe wagging the woodsman around. Okay? Or as if the staff should lift him who is not wood. Okay? How bizarre. The axe and the saw do not set themselves in motion, but they're put in motion by another. Yet, as Wilhelmus of Brockle explains, this is wholly in keeping with their nature. In other words, is God violating the nature of creatures when he causes them to move? He says God sets them in motion in harmony with their nature by means of his cooperative influence. Do you violate the nature of an axe when you wield it in the woods? No. You actually move the axe to perform what is proper to its nature. You don't violate the nature of an axe. You cause it to move in concurrence with its nature. Okay? This is how God acts with created causes. A brief definition, then, of concurrence at this point. Louis Burkhoff, in his Manual of Christian Doctrine, puts it this way. It is that work of God by which he cooperates with all his creatures and causes them to act precisely as they do. We'll talk about that word cooperation because maybe that troubles you. God cooperates? It sounds like a sort of, 50-50 partnership. That's absolutely not what we mean. But hold on to that because cooperation is the right word, but it must be qualified. Brockle, a little more at length, describes it this way. All creatures have received an independent and unique existence from God. Not independent from God so that they exist without his influx, but in the sense of they exist as substances, per se, but not a se, if you care. Unique, and so are able to move in a manner unique to themselves. They set themselves in motion. That's literally an automobile, okay? You are an automobile. You are able to set yourself. You have powers in you to set yourself in motion. As a man, for instance, walks, speaks, and works, all of which he does of himself. And here he brings in concurrence. Since every creature exists, however, by the energizing and preserving power of God, and would not be able to exist without this, each creature's activity comes about by the influence of God's cooperative power, without which it would not be able to move. It is your nature to move, but the actual moving, the power of moving, just like the power of being, comes from God. God doesn't give you being but not movement. God gives you activity and existence. So Brockle says, as is its manner of existence, so likewise its manner of motion. That is to say, we cannot move independently of God if we don't exist independently of God, because you can only move in so much as you are, and you can only be in so much as God makes you be. Therefore, there can never be, in other words, you have to exist before you do things. But if your existence is utterly and radically dependent upon God, then your movement necessarily is going to have to be radically and utterly dependent upon God as well. Both existence and motion, he says, are dependent upon God. This is important that we understand, then, the nature of second causes. There can be no causal operation of the creature apart from the causal operation by which the creature exists, namely God actively causing all creatures to be at any moment of their existence. Movement, actually doing things now that you're here, now that you exist, actually, combing your hair and having a meal and building a house and all these sorts of things that you do as an agent. Movement of the agent presupposes being. And derived, that is non-ase being, depends at every moment on that power by which it exists. Thus, all non-divine powers of operation and agency are caused causes, or moved movers, if you will. In the theological literature, we often refer to these as secondary causes, in distinction from God, who is the primary cause of all things. In our confession, we say that God providentially orders the affairs of the world, even those that appear to us to be chance events, he orders them to fall out in accordance with natural secondary causes. This is the important point. God's work of ordinary providence does not hover above the order of cause and effect in the natural world, but rather runs straight through it. God's providence does not, as it were, compete with causal agency among creatures. Rather, it causes causal agency among creatures. God isn't sort of in a standoff with creaturely causes. There are no creaturely causes where there is not God making them be and move, actually. So what can we say with regard to Scripture's witness to this? Again, I'm going to do sort of the carpet-bombing approach and just survey a series of texts ever so briefly. First, with regard to natural, what I want you to see in these texts is simply this. The text describes things that are susceptible to a natural causal explanation, whether laws of nature or acts of human will or what have you. The text is not taking away the agency of the creature, but it's also identifying the agency of God in the exact same operation. Acts 14:17. He did not leave himself without witness in that he did good and gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. Could we attribute that to, like, say, the germination process and to some sort of evaporation process by which water is, again, pulled into the skies and condensed into clouds and moved over land? In other words, could you give a meteorological, natural, causal explanation of how clouds form and bring rain over land and how when it falls, it causes the germination process to get going and bring, in other words, yes, you could do all of that. And yet God says, I do these things. He's not canceling out the second causes. He works in and through them. Psalm 65, 9 to 11. He says, you visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide their grain, for so you have prepared it. You water its furrows abundantly, settling its ridges, softening it with showers and blessing its growth. You crown the year with your bounty. Your wagon tracks overflow with abundance. Seed falls off the wagon and the rains come down and you see little sprouts growing up where the wagon traveled. And the idea is, could you give a natural causal explanation of these events? The answer is yes, you could. That does not cancel out divine causality. Human choices, then. Now we move to a different type of cause. Those are natural causes. Let's talk about volitional causes. Philippians 2, most famously, so then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Is that something you are supposed to do? Agency, yes. For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. So is it God or is it you? Yes. Lamentations 3:37. Who is there who speaks and it comes to pass unless the Lord has commanded it? When we get to the question on evil, I'll revisit that text. Who is there who speaks and it comes to pass? Lots of people have plans and bring them about successfully, but none do so apart from the concurrence, that is to say, the command and the purposes of God making it so. Most famously, perhaps, with regard to will in the Old Testament, Exodus 7:3, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Exodus 8:32, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Should we split the difference, 50-50? Is that how it is? We can at least say this. We'll talk about how we should think about this. But we should say that God did it, and he did it. And we should not allow one agency to cancel out or make rubbish of the other one. More text on that, anyway. Psalm 18, David talking about overtaking his enemies. I pursued my enemies and overtook them, and I did not turn back until they were consumed. I shattered them so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet. Wow. Did David accomplish things as an agent in battle? Great and mighty things indeed. He goes on, for you, God, have girded me with strength for battle. You have subdued under me those who rose up against me. So who won the battle? Did David win the battle? Yes, David won the battle. Did God win the battle? Yes, God won the battle. Did David do one part and God another part? That's where the question comes in. The answer to that is no. Genesis 45:5. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves, Joseph says to his brothers, because you sold me here. There's agency, by the way. They sold him there. He says, for God sent me before you to preserve life. You sold me, God sent me. At one and the same moment, I mean, from either perspective, it's the exact same thing that's being brought about. Joseph is being taken down to Egypt. Who caused that? Did the brothers cause it? You sold me, he says. He's putting it on them. Did God cause it? God sent me, he says. Are we getting the idea that we have double agency? Okay. And then again, Genesis 50, reflecting on the same thing. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about the present result and preserve many people alive. You meant, God meant. Are there two intentional, that's what meaning is, intending, are there two intentional acts of agency in the one event of Joseph's being sent into slavery? And the answer is yes. Not deism, not pantheism, not eclipsing the human agency on the one side, and not ruling out the divine on the other. Then as for unintended or what we might call chance events, Exodus 21, 12 and 13, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, that is to say, an unintentional act of manslaughter, we would say, then I will appoint you a place to flee. God let him fall into his hand. So is there a causal explanation for freak accidents? Yes, there are causal explanations for those. Is the explanation the intention of a man? No, there is no intentionality here. Is there divine intentionality here? Yes. God works in even the chance events of our lives. Every one of these passages indicates that God is at work in and through natural powers and agencies of both nature and humans, and we could add angels. We are not intended to think that insomuch as God is causally working in and through these things, that there's no cause and effect relationship within the natural order itself. Rather, each natural cause is made to work with God's work. So let's talk very briefly about the kinds of second causes. Our confession names three. These are not unique to our confession or even to Christianity, actually. These are three widely recognized ways in which cause and effect relations go on in the world. It names necessary, free, and contingent causes. This is what our confession is at pains to say, though. Yes, God is the one causing all causes to do any causing. I know that's a lot of repetitious, but you get what I'm after. But this doesn't mean that every cause caused by God does its causing, horizontally speaking, in the same way. The fact that every cause is an instrument of God does not, as it were, flatten out the distinctions between the instruments themselves. The way that a saw cuts down a tree is different, is brought about differently than, like, say, the way that I cause you to know something. That's what I'm supposed to be doing here, I think. I'm supposed to be here as an agent, teaching, which is an act of causation. I'm supposed to be causing form of knowledge to appear in your mind, information. I'm supposed to be the agent of information here. That's an act of causation. It's thoughts in your mind that I'm trying to cause. The way in which I carry out this act of causality and the way that a saw cuts down a tree, both cause-effect relations, are of an entirely different sort, unique to our natures. I'm not a saw, and a saw is not a teacher. Therefore, the way we do our causing as the kinds of things we are not taken away by God. The point is this. Is a saw an instrument in the hand of God? The answer is yes. Is a teacher an instrument in the hand of God? The answer is yes. Are they the same kind of... Since they're both instruments, I guess they're all doing their work, you know, in the horizontal, you know, mundane world the same way. And the answer is no. God not only causes all causes to do their causing, he also causes them to do their causing with respect to the kinds of things that they are, the natures that we have. Briefly then, necessary, free, and contingent. We could go into great depth on this. I'm going to try to resist that. First, with regard to what they mean by necessary causes, these are natural causes whose effects or outcomes are invariable and universal whenever these causes operate. These would include natural laws like those of thermodynamics, conservation of energy, those of motion, inertia, resistance, other laws like laws of gravity and so forth. These are not laws of logic that they're talking about here so much as naturally necessary laws. In other words, is gravity going to continue doing what it does 10 minutes from now? You never say, well, we'll wait and see. It works of natural. There's a natural necessary relation that causes this body with a center of gravity to pull upon our mass, and you know, I'm not going to get into that. But you understand what we're after here. There are some, in terms of like physical laws, mechanical laws, necessary relations. They don't sometimes, you know, it's not that sometimes gravity holds you down and sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes objects in motion continue to stay in motion unless acted on by an outside force, and then sometimes they just stop. It's not, this is what we mean by necessary, naturally necessary in a law-like way. Secondly, then, he mentions, so sometimes what God does is he does his operation through laws or necessary features of the cosmos as he's made it that way. He also mentions free causes. When it speaks of free causes, it's referring to acts of will, human or angelic, which also can operate in the natural world as causes that are free with respect to other potential causes of their action, naturally speaking. So when you say free will, we have a whole chapter on of free will, and we affirm free will, and I've met Calvinists say, I'm a Calvinist, I don't believe in free will. That's completely untethered from anything like historical Reformed theology. We always affirm free will, but here's the question. You should be able to answer this question when you say you affirm free will. Free from what? Free from what? Free from God? No, that's impossible. Free from other potential natural causes explaining your activity? Yes, relatively free. So that, let's put it this way. In terms of what brought such and such about, sometimes the best explanation is a physical natural law. Sometimes it's a contingent event. Sometimes it's a choice you made. So that among the world of things that do some causing, your will happens to be, in the natural world, one of the causal agents that sometimes is the best explanation of an event. And in that respect, it's free from coercion by other natural causes. And in fact, when our confession in 9:1, in the first section, affirms free will, it says, God has endued the will of man with that, it's key, do not miss this, natural liberty. That is to say, liberty with regard to its nature in the world of other natural causes, it's free from those. It goes on, the natural liberty and power of acting upon choice, that it is neither forced nor by any necessity of nature. This is so huge. Not, first of all, it is compelled by necessity of the divine decree, but it's not compelled by the necessity of other potential natural causes, by no necessity of nature determined to do good or evil. You can't point to a law of nature or a contingent event and shove the blame off on that. Okay? This is that freedom. If we were to visit the Black Hills in South Dakota, visit the mountains there, and we were to ask questions about what caused the formation of various mountains in the Black Hills. Any number of material causes might plausibly be offered by a geologist that can explain how certain minerals are condensed and formed in a geological sense. But if we were to ask about the formation of the faces on Mount Rushmore, it's also in the Black Hills, the best causal account would not be that of the material necessities and contingencies described by the geologists, but rather the best account of why these faces of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Roosevelt appear on the side of the mountain would not be natural causes, wind and rain and pressure and condensing. In other words, it wouldn't be a natural geological or meteorological type explanation. Rather, the best explanation of how those faces got there is that somebody intended to do it. I don't even have to tell you that, right? You're traveling the Black Hills, beautiful part of South Dakota, and then you come to Mount Rushmore and you're thinking, well, that's an interesting geological formation, you know, and you're saying to yourself, no, I got the feeling that something other than material natural causes is at work here. In fact, the best explanation, causally speaking, of why those presidential likenesses appear on the side of Mount Rushmore is not the answer that the geologist could give you. It's the answer that somebody intended to do it and carried out their intention as an act of will. Human will is the best causal explanation for how that effect was produced. Relatively free from something else. In other words, free from natural necessities, the will can inaugurate and bring about an event. Faces on the side of a mountain and so forth. Finally, then, contingent causes. These are those natural causes that can be prevented from producing their effects. That is to say, like, for instance, trees. Trees may be prevent, if, even though trees may naturally produce fruit, they may be, because of contingencies, prevented from doing so. Extreme heat, a hard freeze, a hailstorm, lack of water, lack of pollination. If there are no bees, your tree, which naturally produces fruit, will not do so because of a contingency, namely the absence of bees. Okay, so that while it's natural for trees to produce fruit, it's not inevitable in terms of natural necessity that they will do so. Rather, it's a contingent outcome caused by other contingent causes. Aquinas observes that since there are many things among proximate causes that may be defective, that is to say, sometimes it comes about and sometimes it doesn't, not all effects subject to providence will be necessary. He means naturally necessary, but a good many are contingent. If we misunderstand Thomas, if we think he means that God decrees certain things and he leaves it open as to whether certain things will come about or not, and we'll just wait and see. That's not what he means. He means that the cause-effect relation in some cases is due to a natural necessity of nature, and sometimes it's due to a confluence of contingent causes. That's what he means. Both are providentially administered by God. Every good farmer knows that next year's crop, in terms of natural necessity, is never certain. If I say to my father, who's a farmer, you know, are you going to have a harvest in the spring? He will say, very modestly, I hope so. If I say to my father, hey, do you think the law of inertia is going to keep, you know, things in motion unless impeded by an outside force come springtime? He doesn't say, well, I hope so. if we have a good pollination season, then the law of inertia is going to keep, you know, in other words, it's contingent upon a number of other things that may or may not happen that the fruit comes about or the fruit does not come about. Of course, there is no contingency in God's decree and purpose for the world. That is to say, God doesn't decree open-endedly, waiting to see, you know, like a choose-your-own-adventure. Some of you remember those sort of stories where an author sort of gives free play to the reader and you can kind of decide which end comes about. God just sets the parameters, so to speak. That's not what we mean. When we say that he decrees contingencies, we're talking about the relation between one natural cause and one natural effect. There's no contingency with regard to God's decree and purpose for the world. Neither is there a divine natural necessity that he create or cause the world either, but nevertheless. But the decree does include contingent relations among natural causes and effects within the world. Or to put differently, God does not decree contingently so that it may or may not happen, but he does decree contingencies. He does not decree open-endedly, but he does decree contingent cause-effect relations among natural causes and natural effects. Anyway, the whole point of the confession is to say that divine providence does not work against these natural ways of causation, free, contingent, and necessary, but rather in and through them. Thomas says, divine providence does not superimpose necessity on things by entirely excluding contingency from things. Okay? By the decree, if my father will have a crop next spring, according to the decree, it will come about, immutably, infallibly, right, as our confession says. But with regard to the natural causes by which God will make it come about, it is contingent. Can't have too much. Can't have a hard freeze, can't have a 110-degree day, can't have a hailstorm, got to have the bees. Okay. From the one perspective, it is brought about contingently, even if it is immutable with regard to the divine decree. God can decree to bring things about immutably through contingent causes. Or free causes, or necessary causes. Now to the challenge of multiple agents, and this is where it gets a little dicey for us. It might seem, this is what I call the problem of superfluity. That is to say, if God can cause all things, what's the point of having second causes at all? If the primary cause can produce everything immediately, then why have secondary causes at all? Some might wonder how one action, such as the growth of a tree, can flow from two agents. If there's a natural causal explanation for the growth of a tree, like the germination process, then are we not needlessly multiplying causes if we say God causes it to grow? This is actually the sort of naturalistic fallacy of modernity, which basically says, we don't need your God of the gaps anymore. Now we know how nature causes things, therefore we have no need of God to cause things anymore. The only reason that argument would ever seem plausible is if you accept the pagan cosmology that says there can only be one cause with regard to one effect. If the creature causes it, God doesn't. If God does, the creature doesn't, right? It is the old pagan cosmology that denies the creator-creature distinction. As soon as the creature best explains an action, like the germination process, we don't need to say God causes trees to grow anymore. Superfluity problem. Or inversely, from the pantheist side, if God's power is sufficient to bring about natural effects, then would it not be superfluous to use natural causes in the production of natural effects? And our confession says in 5:3 that God can produce natural effects without using the natural causes. We call these miracles. We believe in this. So why doesn't he do this with everything everywhere? And isn't God sort of gumming up the gears by bringing too many? In other words, the fewer moving parts, the better. If God can do it immediately, what's the point of making creatures do any causing? And if the creatures do causing on the other side, how could God do any causing? Thomas says that there are two things that we have to keep in mind when we think about an agent. First, the thing itself. And then he says, secondly, the power by which it acts. He says, but the power of a lower agent, a subordinate agent, like a second cause necessary for your contingent, depends on the power of the superior agent, according as the superior agent gives power to the lower agent whereby it may act, or preserves it, or even applies it to the action as the artisan applies an instrument to its proper effect. So his point is simply this, that there's no competition between God and secondary causes, just like there's no competition, so to speak, between Da Vinci and the brush with which he paints. Is there a sense in which the brush with which he paints causes the Mona Lisa? I mean, come on, you can see brush strokes. Let's all say that the brush had some power to bring about a painting on canvas, okay? But that brush cannot apply itself to action. It must be moved by a higher cause. The brush is a real cause of the painting, but it's not a completely sufficient cause of the painting. It requires an agency higher than itself. It has the ability to smear paint well, but it does not have the ability to actually apply itself to action, for which it requires a painter. So should we say that there are not two causes in the painting of a, in other words, we can hierarchically say Da Vinci is the more primary cause in that relationship, hierarchically, to the brush. But that doesn't cancel out that the brush is actually doing something, smearing paint on canvas. Aquinas says this, so it is necessary for the action of a lower agent, a caused cause, a moved mover, to result not only from the agent by its own power. Does God give you power to act? Yes. Is that sufficient for your acting? No. You must also be, as it were, moved or applied to action. He says, but also the power of all higher agents must be present. It acts thus through the power of all. Just as the lower agent is found immediately active, the brush on canvas, so also the power of the primary agent is found immediate in the production of the effects. If God should, as it were, withdraw his activity, all hierarchically arranged causes, all the way down to the last and most immediate cause, would disappear. So that we can't say, well, God started the process way back when, kicked it into motion, and now he's removed himself. Rather, the moving of all the moved movers immediately comes from the power of the one who causes not just movement to begin, but also movement to continue, just like he causes being to begin and being to continue. For the power of the primary agent is found immediate in the production of the effect, for the power of the lower agent is not adequate to produce this effect of itself. That would be to say, in an aussay sort of way. As the one whose power runs through the entire hierarchy of natural agents, without which there would be no order of agents, God's power is necessary to the production brought about by any natural cause. Again, Thomas says, though a natural thing produces its proper effect, it is not superfluous for God to produce it, since the natural thing does not produce it except by divine power. Do brushes actually smear paint on canvas? Yes, they do. Do brushes smear paint on canvas of themselves? No, they don't. In which case you have an agency unique and proper to the brush as a caused cause, but its application to action is from God. Now, we do confess that God is free to work without, above, and against all of these things, this order of natural causes, according to his own pleasure. So we should say that they are not, it is not absolutely necessary that God have second causes. In other words, it's not like God is limited unless he has second causes, because he can produce effects like he could produce the Mona Lisa with no brushes. That Da Vinci can't do. But God could do that. God could immediately produce outcomes that could be traced back to natural causes, but without any natural causes. This is the power of miracles. So why have natural causes? In other words, but what's the point then? Shouldn't you do, you know, don't good managers do more with less? Right? The law, the sort of economy of scale. Get as many moving parts out as you can in order to do the work most efficiently. So why does God cause other causes to do causing and then apply them to action? Thomas gives an answer that even the staunchest Calvinist should admire. He says, nor is it superfluous, even, if God can by himself produce all natural effects, for them to be produced by other certain causes. In other words, it's just because God can do it without other natural causes, second causes, it's not superfluous that he does so. He says, for this is not a result of the inadequacy of divine power. It's not because God doesn't have the power to produce the effects without us, or, you know, laws of nature, or that kind of thing. He says, but of the immensity of his goodness, whereby he willed to communicate his likeness to things, not only so that they might exist, but also so that they might be causes for other things, end quote. What he's saying is this, that in causing causes, God is in a certain sense causing a reflection of himself in the creature, so that we don't just have beings, we also have agents. God is a being, but he's an agent. He's a doer. He's a maker. And in so much as he puts a power of making or doing in the creature, Thomas says that he's doing it to show himself, so that we can look at causal agents and think up to the one first cause, as it were, the one who is the reason for all things whatsoever. So that it is, in fact, it's not necessary that God creates second causes, because there's no limitation to his power, but he does it in order to, as it were, refract or repackage into the creature a sort of reflection of his own causal power. I think it's a great answer, and one that should be agreeable to us. It would be strange, though, if we should set the creature's agency in opposition to God's agency, since the creature's agency is but a created similitude of uncaused causal power. In other words, this is a caused imitation of an uncaused creative power. We shouldn't set the imitation in opposition to the original. Okay. Finally then, or another point, subordinate but not coordinate cooperation. Maybe that word cooperation troubles you. God cooperates with the creature. It sounds like synergism, right? This idea that God saddles up alongside someone else and says, hey, the two of us could do better than just the one of us. Let's work together, right? Cooperation, is that what we mean? The answer is emphatically no. We argue for a subordinate, not coordinate, cooperation. 1 Corinthians 3:9, Paul says, we are God's fellow workers. Fellow workers with God, working together with the power of God? For many, this is understood to mean that God shares a percentage, not the total, but a percentage of the work in his cooperative production of the single effect with the creature. God does his part, the creature does his part, and together they pull off the intended result. You know, teamwork, right? This sort of cooperation should be characterized as what I would call coordinate cooperation. This isn't just cooperation, this is coordination. By that I mean that God and the creature are both conceived in this model as first order principles. You're an autonomous agent, I'm an autonomous agent, but together we can do more. Let's team up, let's sign a contract, let's get together, let's get the work done. Aquinas says, this is not his own view, he's characterizing this view. He says, this is as when two men carry a single burden or drag a boat. Now, you can imagine someone pulling up to the lake edge and they're going to pull the boat out of the water, but it's kind of a heavy boat, and one guy grabs one part and the other guy grabs another part, and together you each do the work by percentages. No one person is actually doing all of it, and it's really like this. To the extent that the one man acts to drag the boat, to the extent that he's actually causing the boat to be dragged, to exactly that extent, the other one isn't causing it to be dragged, and vice versa. So let's just say that it's a very strong man and a young boy. The grown man might be pulling 80%, you know, pulling 80% of the weight, and the boy might be pulling 20% of the weight, exactly to the extent that the grown man causes the boat to be dragged. It's just to that extent that the boy is not causing the boat to be dragged. Does this make sense? So this is a coordination. What makes it coordination is not that it's cooperation. What makes it coordination is that neither operator is the cause of the other operator. In other words, what makes this coordinate is that both, in a certain sense, are primary in that action. Two independent causes simply team up to produce a single outcome. Each one does his part of the work, and to the extent that the one contributes something to the effect, to just that extent, the other one doesn't. Is this what we mean? You do your part, God does his part, you do 20, he does 80, together you get to heaven, or you know, whatever it is that you're doing together with God. Yet this sort of cooperation is theologically problematic for this very reason. It's built on the faulty cosmology of pantheism and deism that basically says, if God acts, the creature doesn't, or if the creature acts, God doesn't. Okay? The whole assumption in this coordination cooperation is basically a pagan cosmology. God acts, I don't. I act, God doesn't, but it couldn't be any other way. God can't act in and through me. He can only act alongside of me. Put differently, if God is to act causally in the world, then to just that extent, the creature does not, and vice versa. The problem with this is it conceives God's agency as a finite cause that must somehow fit itself within a single causal order with other natural causes. In other words, God has to, as it were, find a place to do his work where others aren't already working. Right? Kind of like, you know, a man's dragging the boat, you know, let's just say the boy's dragging the boat and he's having a difficult time, and the man comes along and says, I'll help you with that, and he jumps in and, you know, starts pulling, and then together they get the job done. The man can only jump in to the extent that someone else isn't already there doing the pulling. He can only contribute up to 80% because the boy's already doing 20% of the causing, so to speak. Is God like this? Is God like a natural cause who has to sort of negotiate his relationship to the world with other natural causes, trying to find a place for him to do his work? Okay? That would be the coordination approach. Just as one created cause must share space, so to speak, with another, or share a fraction of the work in the production of a single effect, so God's causal agency must share space with the creature's causal action. What should we say instead? We should instead say that God cooperates with the creature not in a coordinating way, but in a subordinating way. That is to say, the creature causes not as a coordinate principle, but as a subordinate one, as a cause. The difference between the man and the boy is the man doesn't cause the boy to be or move, right? But that, so it's coordination. But when God works with us, he doesn't just, as it were, saddle up alongside of us and supplement what we're not doing. He makes us do our doing. He causes us to be. John Norton, an American theologian, colonial theologian, Congregationalist teacher in New England, his work, The Orthodox Evangelist, 17th century, he says this, a coordinate cause works of itself, not depending upon its co-working cause or causes, like the boy, even though he does 20%, does not depend upon the man for his agency. A subordinate cause, though, is that which depends upon its superior cause in respect of its working as an officer upon the magistrate. An absolute subordinate cause is that which depends upon its superior cause in respect of its working. So all second causes depend upon the first cause. So how does God work with us? How does God cooperate with us? He cooperates with us by causing us to operate. Okay? By causing us to be and do. Causing us to be and move. Applying us to making us be and applying us to action. A little bit from Wilhelmus of Brockel on this. One should not understand this cooperation to be such as if God were collaterally involved in the activity of the creature, as is true when two horses draw a wagon. Right? Got a couple of Clydesdales hitched up. And to the extent that the one pulls the wagon, the other one doesn't, and vice versa, we should not think of it as a collateral action. You and God together make a great team. Okay, something like that. We should not think of, you know, God is not your co-pilot. Not that kind of, in other words, the relationship is not of two coordinate agents, it's of a primary agent and a subordinate agent who's actually caused to be and move by the other agent, the primary. God, we should not think of this as God collaterally involved with us. It's not collateral would mean on the same playing field in terms of causality. It's not that way. He causes our causality. This, he says, this would mean that the creature, by virtue of a God-given innate ability, would then function independently, rather than that God would energize that creature in order for it to be in motion. This would additionally mean that God would merely join himself to the activity of a moving creature, executing his task jointly, each by exercising power independently. This is the end of the creator-creature distinction if we think that the cooperation is coordination, because then you have a multitude of first causes teaming up. You don't have a first and second cause distinction. You don't have a creator-creature distinction. You have two self-sufficient, independent beings. God's initiative, he says, precedes the motion of the creature, however, stipulating the creature to a specific object, place, and time. God gave us our times and habitation and the boundaries of them. And in him we live, move, and have our being. He says, we therefore understand the cooperation of God not merely to refer to his omnipotent and omnipresent power, whereby he preserves the existence and faculties of all creatures so as to be a special, but as also to be a special physical, natural, immediate, and tangible operation by which he precedes the creature in every motion, first to second, directing this motion and preserving the created object while in motion. Maybe we could just simply refer to Romans 11:36. For from him and through him, and to him are all things. Does that mean, this is the way I put it with undergrads with regard to the will. I start very simply. Do you exist? Yes, I do. What makes you to be? God does. Do you do anything? That is to say, do you move? Do you act? Yes. What makes you to act? God does. In other words, you don't start dependently on God and then go on independently of God with regard to any aspect of your being. Being or motion. Do you move independently of God? No more than you exist independently of God, do you move independently of him. Finally then, God and the creature are both, this is my final consideration for this talk, are both immediate to the effect. In other words, when we think that God is the unmoved mover, we should not think that that means he is not immediately present in the production of all things, as if he were the, you know, simply the guy who flicked over the first domino and then left the room while all the other dominoes sort of did their little work. Rather, his cause, as the immediate cause of being, the thing with which if you pulled that cause away, we would cease to be because existence does not become an aspect of our nature, God has to be the one who is immediately applying us to all action in so much as we would not exist independently of him, nor could we move independently of him, because we cannot act in a way superior to the way we are. Okay. So, doesn't this mean, though, that at least with regard to any individual thing that comes about, that the creature is, you know, somewhere down the chain of causing, doesn't this mean the creature being the proximate agent, the immediate cause of the effect? I'm the immediate cause of, you know, say the watch dropping, you know, or gravity is. Somebody's the immediate cause bringing that about. Does this mean that God is the first cause in the sense of way back there in the history of causes, he has a place, but in terms of the immediate cause of this or that thing, he's not present? It might seem like God is a step removed from all effects, simply the first cause, you know, way, way, way back. If you used a saw to cut a fallen tree into firewood, there'd be a sense in which the saw would do no cutting without someone to move it. There would be another respect in which the saw was more immediate to the effect than the woodcutter himself. When it comes to the actual sawing of wood and the gathering of sawdust, there is a closeness of the saw to that production than there is of me. For me, the instrument puts me like the brush. The brush is sort of removes Da Vinci one step from the production, right? Because what you see are, yes, movements produced by Da Vinci, but Da Vinci's hand is not a brush, so that the strokes, if he just had no instrument and he just took his bare hand and tried to do the Mona Lisa, I take it that, you know, nobody would be lining up at the Louvre to see it. Okay, whatever, it would just be a mess. So that there's a sense in which you think, well, instruments, as it were, stand in between primary causes and effects. Therefore, if God uses us instrumentally, there must be some distance between God and the things produced. And yet, this is not what we're saying about God's relation to all natural effects. His instrumental use of the creature in providence does not remove his power from the immediate production of the effect. And this is because created instruments have no power of their own that is not wholly from God himself. This is not how Da Vinci relates to his brushes. When Da Vinci leaves the room and doesn't even think about his brushes, you know what happens to his brushes? They just sit there soaking in that can of water, waiting for him to come back. They exist independent of him, and when he uses them as an instrument, they are, as it were, given to him. Okay? They do not, in an absolute sense, depend upon Da Vinci for their being, but only for their motion. But this is the difference. All created instruments depend upon God not only for our motion, but also for our being. And in this respect, there's a necessary immediacy of God to all productions. In fact, Aquinas makes the argument that as first cause, God is more immediately present to natural effects than natural causes, because it's God himself who actually establishes the bond. You know, you think of like hydrogen atoms and oxygen atoms and a water molecule are bound together by some covalent bonding. But what Thomas would say, but God is the one who causes the bonding to happen, so that God not only ordains that natural causes would cause natural effects, but he's also the one who in his power causes the causal conjunction, the connection that actually does the causing to actually be there. A little bit from Thomas's On the Power of God. If then we consider the subsistent agent, every particular agent is immediate to its effect. But if we consider the power whereby the action is done, then the power of the higher cause is more immediate to the effect than the power of the lower cause, since the power of the lower cause is not coupled with its effect save by the power of the higher cause. I'll just stop there. Come back to the man sawing a fallen tree in the forest. The connection of the higher cause when it's God, as opposed to, like, say, a moved mover like a woodsman, is that God is the one who is not only moving the instrument, but he's also the one who is causing the causal connection between the instrument and its production to actually obtain. He doesn't just make instruments and causes, he also causes the causal action itself. And in this respect, we should argue that God is most interior and most immediately present to all things that are produced. I'll leave it with this by way of conclusion. We should by no means think that God's providence is limited to the use of second causes. We emphatically say that it's not. By the same token, though, we ought not to think that the natural cause-effect relation lies outside of God's power of providence. This is not God sort of letting things go their own way, independent of his making it be so. Rather, ordinary providence manifests itself in and through this order as that which accounts for the very existence and regular operation of it. As the Apostle Paul says when pointing to the provision of rains and fruitful harvests, he, God, did not leave himself without witness. Far from taking away the reality and the diversity of natural causes, God's providence is actually what establishes and makes natural causes be and move. For this reason, we ought to reject all false choices between God and nature. Did God make that happen, or did nature make that happen? We should rather, in terms of cooperative subordination, say that God made that happen through the regular operation of natural agents, which he sustains in being and applies to action at every instant of their existence. God is not competing with natural causes. He is causing natural causes to be and to move. This raises a series of questions that I will begin to, and not adequately, but begin to address in our next talk, which is the question of what about when natural causes produce evil things and do sinful actions? Can we not extricate God a little bit from that in order to get him off the hook? That's the temptation. I'll give us some reasons to resist it when we reconvene. Thanks.